The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Knoll, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
I'd like to welcome you to this program. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Just a little background before we go into a very important topic dealing with AIDS and an outstanding panel to share as much insight as we can. I've also not limited our program to the one-hour slot normally held at this time. If it takes longer, we will go into the next hour. Now to our program. Today, we are going to discuss AIDS, but not just about the victims or the virus or the people involved. We're going to look at it with a different perspective. What if everything that we have been told about AIDS is not only easily challengeable and shown to be inaccurate, overstated, or out-and-out fraud, but what if the American media, the world media, the journalists who cover that media, where they may be objective in covering heart disease or cancer, have lost that objectivity when it comes to the subject of AIDS? Not only going to that level, but any journalist who chooses to tell the truth, a scientist who chooses to challenge the existing paradigm, is then personally attacked, irrespective of the facts, the documentation, and their own credibility and background. That is how powerful this topic is. I'm going to begin, before I go to my guest, by sharing a few of the verbatim statements from some outstanding scientists. And why I'm doing this is this. In any other field of medicine or science, if you have some of the leading thinkers, the most respected people in a field, out and out challenging the veracity, the legitimacy of a field, it would make news. First, it would make news within that field because there would be discussions, there would be arguments, there'd be debates. And then the larger community, the American media, would say, what's this battle about? Why are you saying that there is no legitimacy? And it would become an issue. On the subject of AIDS, we have more than 2,300 scientists, physicians, journalists, and activists who have gone on the record to make their feelings known that they feel that there's a great deal of inaccuracy and even fraud in the subject of AIDS, yet not a single comment in the American media about this debate. Let me give some very specific examples. The Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Kerry Mullis, he won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, Biochemistry, in 1993. He invented the polymerase chain reaction, the basis for the HIV viral load test. Here's what he had to say. Quote, it's not even probable, let alone scientifically proven, that HIV causes AIDS. If there is evidence that HIV causes AIDS, there should be scientific documents which either singularly or collectively demonstrate that fact, at least with a high probability. There are no such documents. Separately, the HIV causes AIDS theory is one hell of a mistake. Separately, years from now, people will find our acceptance of the HIV theory of AIDS as silly as we find those excommunicating Galileo. Separately, where is the research that says HIV is the cause of AIDS? There are thousands of people in the world now who specialize in HIV. None has any interest in the possibility that HIV does not cause AIDS because it doesn't. Their expertise is useless. Separately, if you think of virus as the cause of AIDS, do a control with it. To do a control is the first thing you teach undergraduates, but it has not been done. The epidemiology of AIDS is a pile of anecdotal stories selected to the virus-AIDS hypothesis. People don't bother to check the details of popular dogma or consensus views. Now, that's from a Nobel Prize winner whose work is used in AIDS. I also might mention that I spent an entire day with Dr. Kerry Mullis filming him, and he was even more adamant than those statements. But he is not alone. there's another individual, and that is Dr. David Raznick, biochemist, protease inhibitor developer, and formerly at the University of California. A few of his statements. As a scientist who has studied AIDS for years, I have determined that AIDS has little to do with science and is not even primarily a medical issue. AIDS is a sociological phenomenon held together by fear, creating the kind of medical McCarthyism that has transgressed and collapsed all the rules of science and has imposed a brew of belief and pseudoscience on a vulnerable public. Separately, we have put years and hundreds of billions of dollars into HIV. We've got no cure, no vaccine, and no progress. Instead, we have thousands of people made sick and even killed by toxic AIDS drugs. But we can't just treat them for the diseases we know they have, because if we do, we're called AIDS denialists. AIDS is a multi-billion dollar annual industry. There are 100,000 professional AIDS researchers in this country. It's hard to challenge as big as big tobacco was at one point. Separately, those damn HIV tests should be outlawed. They're lethal. First of all, it's a death sentence in South Africa. People commit suicide if they've been stoned to death. They've had their houses burned down. They've been murdered just for having antibodies to HIV. They have been ostracized. And in certain rural communities, ostracism is equivalent to death. So you're scared to death, first of all, and then you start taking the anti-HIV drugs, which cause AIDS, and if you take them long enough, they will kill you. And finally, in 1990, at the San Francisco AIDS Conference, HIV co-discoverer Luc Montagnier announced that HIV did not, after all, kill T-cells and could not be the cause of AIDS. Within hours of making this announcement, he was attacked by the very industry he helped to create. And finally, one more of the thousands of people who've gone on the record is Dr. Charles Thomas. He is a former professor of biochemistry, Harvard and Johns Hopkins University, chair of the Department of Cell Biology, Scripps Research Institute. And he says the following: the HIV causes AIDS dogma is the grandest fraud that has ever been perpetrated on young men and women of the Western world. AIDS is a cruel deception that is maintained because so many people are making money from it. Take away this money and the entire system of mythology will collapse. Separately, even after many years, not one HIV-infected chimp has come down with AIDS. This means we have an animal model for HIV and it doesn't cause AIDS. Separately, by most sensitive PCR and culture procedures, no virus can be detected in 90% of semen samples taken from men with HIV. Separately, the reason that the whole shabby story of HIV is being held in place is there's so much money riding on it. The federal government is spending billions every year just on a single subject, and all those billions is predicated on the idea that HIV caused this disease. If HIV does not cause these diseases, then that money is being wasted, and I believe it is being wasted. But the people who are the recipients of that money don't want it to stop. And let me just add, from the PhD Department of Virology, Royal Postgraduate Medical School in London, Dr. Beverly Griffin, one statement: I do not believe that HIV in and of itself can cause AIDS. But she's not alone. There's also the professor of molecular biology, Harvard University, winner of the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. He says, I would not be surprised if there were another cause of AIDS and even that HIV is not involved. Peter Duisberg is absolutely correct in saying that no one has proven that AIDS is caused by the AIDS virus. And he is absolutely correct that the virus cultured in the laboratory may not be the cause of AIDS. So you have two Nobel Prize winners. You have outstanding academic backgrounds, not a single word in the American media that some of the most preeminent minds in American science have challenged this dogma. Why not? Now to our panelists to take on the issue. We have from Canada, Calgary, David Crowe. David is the president of the Reappraising AIDS Society and a member of the Canadian Association of Journalists. He hosts the RethinkingAIDS.com website, which is science and news resource on all international research and commentary challenging the current HIV-AIDS model. He is the former president and treasurer for the Green Party in Alberta, Canada. Joining him is Celia Farber. She is a journalist who covered the HIV wars extensively since 1987 in various magazines. Some of these writings are collected in her book, Serious Adverse Events, An Uncensored History of AIDS, published by Melville House. Activist Michael Callan called Farber the best AIDS journalist in the world. She also has enemies, of course. Her 2006 article for Harper's Magazine detailing the totalitarian corruption of the HIV-AIDS research was titled Out of Control, AIDS and the Corruption of Medical Science. The attacks from the AIDS industry were predictable and fierce. Still, she won the 2008 Simon Weiss Clean Hands Award for Outstanding Investigative Journalism. And rounding out our panel is Professor Henry Bauer. He is Professor Emeritus of Chemistry and Science Studies and the former dean at Virginia Polytech Institute. After his retirement, he served as editor-in-chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration for 7 years. He is the author of the book The Origin, Persistence and Failings of HIV-AIDS Theory, which was among the first books together two decades of research on HIV and AIDS to identify the scientific contradictions. I'd like to welcome all three of you to our program.
Hi, Gary. It's good to be on your show.
Good. We're going to begin with you, David Crowe. David, if you would, please, for the people in the audience who may not be aware, there is a controversy, who have been out of the loop on this. Let us begin by examining the history of this, of the official science declaring that one single virus, co-discovered by Luc Montagnier and Robert Gallo, was the cause of 30 different conditions that we pull together and call AIDS, that the HIV antibody test is the test to determine if you have the antibody, which will lead to inevitably your death. And the antiretroviral drugs are the thing to take, and that is the end of the argument from their perspective. They control all funding, all research, all legislation, and evidently all media in the world and the subject. The forum is yours. Take us through this history to bring people up to date.
When AIDS was first announced as a new condition, a new syndrome in 1981, there were actually only two diseases, Kaposi sarcoma and PCP pneumonia. And we need to go back to the 1960s to get a little bit of information about that. That was the era in which doctors really started to get serious about organ transplants, and they were able to overcome the issue of rejection by giving their patients immunosuppressive drugs. One of those drugs was called azathioprine, which was a nucleoside analog, which, not to get too technical, it interferes with DNA synthesis. It interfered with the growth of immune cells and therefore suppressed the immune system. They discovered the transplant patients were often coming down with PCP pneumonia and Kaposi sarcoma, the first two conditions known as AIDS in 1981. This was drug-induced illnesses, and it was recognized at that time as drug-induced, and they tried to balance the amount of drugs against the need for immune suppression. So if you go to 1981, in June, five young gay men came down with PCP pneumonia. All of them had used inhalant drugs known as nitrites or poppers. That was quickly ignored. In July of 1981, the CDC made a summary of this new condition, adding in some gay men who had Kaposi sarcoma as well as PCP in the original reports. They didn't mention drug use. But a lot of people were still talking about nitrite inhalants. In the New England Journal of Medicine at the end of 1981, a researcher wrote, "The first eight patients are typically young homosexual men, most of whom live in large cities, and many of whom use drugs. The leading candidates as the cause of this condition are the nitrites, or poppers, which are now commonly inhaled to intensify orgasm. Users of amyl nitrite are more likely than non-users to have had hundreds of sexual partners." So there was this correlation between drug use and the highest levels of promiscuity amongst gay men. Gay men and doctors have the opportunity of blaming this condition on the sexuality of gay men or on the drug use of a small minority, and they chose to blame the sexuality of gay men, which I think is a tragic irony. Robert Gallo, around this time in 1980, published his first paper on what he called human T-cell leukemia virus, eventually called HTLV-1. This was research which was basically done by Japanese researchers, but when he published in 1980, he didn't give them any credit for this. And in the early 1980s, he tried to claim that HTLV-1 was the cause of AIDS, but he had a little bit of difficulty because although this affected CD4 or T cells, it caused them to grow faster than normal, and AIDS supposedly was causing them to die. So it was hard to explain how the same virus could do two different things in different people at different times. At the same time, in between 1981 and 1984, when it was announced that HIV was the cause of AIDS by Gallo, Luc Montagnier at the Pasteur Institute was also doing some research. He discovered what he called his HIV virus in a gay man, but this gay man did not have AIDS. So the initial so-called isolation of HIV, then called LAV by Luc Montagnier, was in a person who did not have AIDS, and there's evidence that the person never did have AIDS. So there was a big fight over what was the cause, and when Gallo realized that Luc Montagnier was making more progress, he suddenly switched sides and started to promote what he called HTLV-3, although it was later determined that the samples that he were using came from the Pasteur Institute, and it was the same virus or whatever these materials were as Luc Montagnier. And preemptively, on April the 23rd in 1984, early in the day, filed two patents claiming a blood test for this new virus, and then later in the day, making a public announcement that HIV was the probable cause of AIDS. But not until early May did he actually publish any papers. And what those papers showed was that his, what he called HTLV-3, now known as HIV, was found in 3 out of 8 juvenile AIDS patients, 13 of 43 adult AIDS patients, and 10 of 21 adult AIDS patients with opportunistic infections. The first set of adult AIDS patients had Kaposi's sarcoma. But on this weak evidence, within a very short time, the entire medical, scientific, political world had accepted that HIV was the singular and only cause of AIDS. As Montagnier's research wasn't a lot different, in July of 1984, he claimed to have found antibodies to HIV in 41% of people with AIDS. So he was getting the same weak results as Gallo, but nobody by this time really cared. They'd found the single cause, and that was the end of it. The patents that Gallo filed in April, in the morning of April 23rd, 1984, were very important for a number of reasons. One of them, it shows that money was an important motivating factor. It was also important for the United States government to take credit. Montagnier had already filed patents some months earlier, and they were sitting on a dusty shelf somewhere, but Gallo's patents were approved in a remarkably short amount of time. Montagnier's not until significantly later. That caused a big fight between the French and the U.S. governments, which eventually was resolved by sharing the royalties for the tests, although in the end it really proved to be more Montagnier's work than Gallo's. Gallo and Montagnier had some interesting things happen to them in later years. In 1986, Gallo was forced to admit that the electron micrographs used in his publications came from Luc Montagnier's laboratory after quite some time of insisting that his research was completely independent. In 1987, Luc Montagnier found natural autoantibodies in people with AIDS, pre-AIDS, or at risk for AIDS, indicating that there was something else going on other than this virus called HIV. But in 1987, AZT, the first AIDS drug, was approved, and by this time, the HIV-AIDS theory was solidly embedded amongst just about everybody. But what we should note about AZT, and this is actually quite remarkable, is that AZT is in the same class of drugs as azathioprine, that immunosuppressive drug that was used in the 1960s and on for immune suppression related to transplants. So an immunosuppressive drug, a drug that attacks DNA and therefore kills growing cells, was given to people who were immune suppressed. obviously a drug like this is going to cause immune suppression. It's not going to cure it. And the death rate from AIDS continued to increase until the mid-1990s. Later in time, in 1988, Robert Gallo had to admit that they had never found the tracks of HIV-1 in Kaposi's sarcoma. And they basically, within a few years, they blamed Kaposi's sarcoma on another virus called HHV-8 or Kaposi's sarcoma herpes virus. This is quite remarkable. Kaposi's sarcoma still remains in the definition of AIDS, yet for most of the history of AIDS, it's been known that there's really no connection between HIV and this condition. By this time in history, in 1990, some big questions about Gallo's research were starting to surface, and the NIH Office of Scientific Inquiry opened an investigation in 1990. And in June of 1991, they found his top lab assistant, Popovich, guilty, and found that Gallo warranted significant censure. In 1992, a slightly different group, the Office of Research Integrity, found Gallo guilty of scientific misconduct. But in 1993, the ORI reversed its decision on Popovich. Basically, lawyers had persuaded these organizations that in order to prove fraud, scientific fraud, you had to prove intent. So in other words, if you changed your notebooks after the fact, after people started investigating, if you changed your notebooks to make it look like you discovered certain things at certain times that you obviously didn't, that would not be fraud unless you could prove intent to defraud. So the legal standard was raised so high that the Office of Research Integrity withdrew their findings of censure and scientific misconduct against Popovich and Gallo. But Gallo was still in big trouble. Congressman Dingell had a huge investigation which resulted in a very large report into the scientific corruption in Gallo's lab. It's a devastating indictment. But in 1995, Newt Gingrich and the Republicans took over Congress, and Dingell's investigations were suspended. So although the report was leaked, it was never officially published and therefore had no consequences for Robert Gallo, although a little later Gallo was kind of sideways pushed into an institute in Baltimore and pushed out of the U.S. government. By this time in 1995, AIDS deaths were still growing annually, but in 95, 96, they started to reduce, well, they had been reducing the dosage of AIDS drugs, and in 1995, they started to hand out the less toxic protease inhibitors. And so naturally, the death rate started to decline because the toxicity of the poisons that were given to people who were HIV positive were less. It was about this, a little bit later, in 1997, when a journalist in France named Jamal Tahi did an interview with Luc Montagné and was able to get Luc Montagné to admit that he had never purified the virus. This is one of the most stunning facts about HIV. It has never been purified. Now, virologists sometimes use the term isolation, but by isolation they do not mean that the virus has been purified. They mean a lot less than that. And so Montagné says in this interview that despite what he called a Roman effort, they were not able to purify the virus. They found pictures of cells in cell cultures that were budding. They assumed those buds were retroviruses, but Luc Montagné said, and this is a quote, "Having said that, on the morphology or the shape alone, one cannot say it was truly a retrovirus." Luc Montagné said, "I repeat, we did not purify. We purified to characterize the density of the reverse transcriptase, which was that of a retrovirus. In other words, they found a characteristic of a retrovirus, but we did not analyze the peak, or it didn't work, because if you purify, you damage the virus." So they came up with this convenient theory that the reason they couldn't purify was because HIV was so weak and fragile that if you did anything to it, it just fell apart. And yet somehow, you know, when it was on a dirty needle or it was in semen, it had no troubles at all going from one person to another. Another interesting thing, as we went through the late 80s and into the 90s, Luc Montagnier started to say a lot of things that contradicted the mainstream views on HIV and AIDS that had become cemented at this time. For example, he started to write about cofactors. So what he's saying there is that HIV by itself is not the cause, but maybe mycobacteria are necessary to cause AIDS. He also started to write about antioxidants. And as time went on, he became more and more firm in his belief that AIDS was a disease of oxidative stress and that nutritional therapy could be used to reverse many of the effects of oxidative stress. In fact, in 2006, Montagnier wrote a preface for a book in French, and the title translated to English is The Revolution of Antioxidants, Slow Aging and Prevent Illnesses. And in 2008, he actually co-authored a book, Live Longer in Good Health with an Extraordinary Ally, Fermented Papaya, which is an antioxidant. He's also published scientific papers on antioxidants and oxidative stress, but he avoids talking about the application of antioxidants to AIDS when he's writing a scientific article. Montagnier, when push comes to shove, will not confront the AIDS establishment, even though he's held up as an icon and won the Nobel Prize in 2008, the same year he was writing about the use of natural products to reverse oxidative stress. In going back a little bit, in 2002, John Crutzen published a book on Robert Gallo. John Crutzen was a science journalist for the Chicago Tribune, and this was a devastating indictment of Robert Gallo, pulling together many of the documents from the government inquiries, the Dingell Commission, which had been leaked. And one would have expected Gallo to turn around and sue John Crutzen, because it basically accuses him of scientific fraud and lying to the U.S. Patent Office, which is a criminal offense, and many other things. And despite all of these allegations, there's never been a lawsuit from Robert Gallo back against John Crutzen, and so one has to assume that the allegations made in this devastating book from 2002 are true. One more thing, by the end of early 1990s, in 1993 to be exact, the Centers for Disease Control had redefined AIDS to be not a disease at all. In 1993, they said if you had a low CD4 immune cell count and a positive HIV test, you could be diagnosed with AIDS, which was very profitable for a lot of different groups. As soon as you were diagnosed with AIDS, states and local governments were eligible for funding. The patient was eligible for drugs, which many patients thought was a good thing. And by 1997, about two-thirds of new AIDS cases were in people who had no illness. And so AIDS was perhaps the first of the virtual illnesses where your doctor can tell you you're dying because your CD4 counts are low and because you have a positive HIV test, but you don't have any symptoms. But just wait. If you don't take these toxic drugs like nucleoside analogs and protease inhibitors, you will die. And that message has continued to be very powerful and causes a lot of people to take drugs that will eventually cause liver failure, kidney failure, serious fatal anemia, or if it doesn't kill them, it will just make their lives miserable through vomiting, diarrhea, pain called neuropathy, and many other debilitating conditions. So, Gary, did I miss anything in that quick history of HIV and AIDS?
I just want to repeat something here, David. You're listening to David Crowe. I'm Gary Knoll. This is a very important hour discussing a paradigm. We're going to go to other two panelists in a moment. Go back to the original article that Gallo wrote. First, as a science journalist, do you find it unusual that a person would announce they have found the cause of a disease yet had not published any scientific papers to prove that point? And then secondly, take us through something very unusual, and that is that the head Popovic, the head of Gallo's lab at the National Cancer Institute, had written up the actual article that was to be submitted to Science magazine. And in that article, he made several statements that completely refuted everything that Gallo would later say. He did not find an AIDS-causing virus. The head of the National Cancer Institute's division that handles the electron microscope said they could not find a retrovirus to photograph, that it was cellular debris, but not a retrovirus, an HIV virus, and that what he was doing was not shown to be killing all these T cells, many things that are completely the opposite of what the final report was. Gallo comes back from being in Europe promoting his antibody test and finds the manuscript on his desk. And Popovic went off, I believe, somewhere out west to a skiing vacation. He immediately gets him on the phone, demands he comes back. And when Popovic comes back, he has handwritten in all of the columns and all this manuscript, he changed it. And Popovic, for whatever reasons we do not know, sent a copy of that manuscript to a family member. For years, it was there. And even the investigators didn't pay attention to some of the statements that were in the original manuscript. And it was Janine Roberts, the great legendary reporter who brought us Blood Diamond stories and Aboriginal abductions and rape in the Congo. Wonderful, insightful mind she has. And 40 years as a top investigator, she brought this story to our attention. Now, there are a lot of scientists who have joined in a petition and others to say to Science Magazine, retract the articles. They are fraudulent. I want you to get into that. I want you to get into why it's so important that we understand what happened with that original article, the very foundation upon which the entire AIDS edifice rests, is being challenged by Janine Roberts and others is a complete fraud. Talk right about that in detail.
Yeah. Well, I guess the best parallel I can come up with is it's kind of like a lot of the Iraq war documents, and the phrase that was used in England was the documents were sexed up. In other words, when they really didn't have anything, they just invent something exciting. They invented exports of uranium from Africa to Iraq to make it look like there were weapons of mass destruction. And Gallo was basically doing the same thing. When Popovic, for example, tried to give credit to Luc Montagnier because he obtained samples from Luc Montagnier, Gallo wrote things like, "You're crazy, Mika," that was Popovic's name, "and you are absolutely incredible, I just don't believe it," because he was trying to give credit to another scientist. So Gallo tried to turn some rather boring results that didn't really mean anything into the absolute proof of that HIV was the cause of AIDS. And he, in fact, wrote on the abstract, he said, "This abstract is rather trivial for a putative breakthrough paper for Science." So Gallo was going to put a paper in Science that was going to say that HIV, or HDLV3, he called it then, was the cause of AIDS. And he wasn't going to let the facts stand in his way. I mean, Popovic ran the lab. Popovic knew what was true and what was not. But Gallo literally scratched a lot of that stuff out and put in what he wished had happened. And even so, as I've quoted, his results were not all that convincing. Only a minority of AIDS patients in the papers published in 1984 were claimed to have HIV detected. So even on that basis, the paper should have been rejected as proof. But that didn't stop Robert Gallo, and it didn't stop most of the rest of the world of accepting this right away. It was on World AIDS Day in 2008 when a number of prominent scientists wrote to the journal Science saying that based on all of these questions about Gallo's papers, for example, his admission a few years later that he'd used electron micrograph from Luc Montagnier without giving credit, that evidence that these papers had been modified to, make them seem much better than they were, lots of evidence that Gallo had faked some of his research, these papers should be withdrawn. And yet science did not even acknowledge receipt of this letter. Because to withdraw, they knew very well that to withdraw the four Gallo papers published in May 1984 would be to pull the rug out from underneath the entire very profitable HIV-AIDS edifice. I mean, to put the profit in context, there are several AIDS drugs that have sales of more than $1 billion a year. So there are no government medical bureaucrats who want to shine light on the corruption of an industry that's worth multiple billions of dollars every year and worth an immense amount of prestige for the U.S. government that supposedly sponsored the research that discovered HIV.
All right. Well, what that tells many people is that the very foundation is challengeable. And do you have a copy of the letter that was sent to Science Magazine? Because the mainstream media didn't touch that at all. And in any other area of medicine or education or politics where you have that many esteemed, credentialed, outstanding reputation experts saying, retract an article, it is not accurate, that would have made headline news and been the topic of constant discussion. Not a word in the mainstream media on this. So, do you have a copy you could read it?
Yes. Just 1 second, and I pull it up, and I can read it.
This is important for our discussion, because when we go to Celia Farber and our other guest, Henry Bauer, we're going to talk about the subversion of science, independent science, for the good of those who control it financially.
Right. Well, it's a little bit of a long letter, but I'll read some of the more critical parts of it. It starts by saying, on May 4th, 1984, your journal published four papers by a group led by Dr. Robert Gallo. We are writing to express our serious concerns with regard to the integrity and veracity of the lead paper amongst those four, of which Dr. Mikulas Popovich is the lead author. The other three are also of concern because they rely upon this paper's conclusions. In the early 1990s, several highly critical reports on the research underlying these papers were produced as a result of governmental inquiries, and it goes on to list those. For example, the ORI, the Office of Research Integrity, believes that the careless and unacceptable keeping of research records reflects irresponsible laboratory management that has permanently impaired the ability to retrace the important steps taken. Despite the publicly available record of challenges to their veracity, these papers have remained uncorrected and continue to be part of the scientific record. And what prompts the current letter, which was 2008, was the recent revelation of an astonishing number of previously unreported deletions and unjustified alterations made by Gallo to the lead paper. And this was the handwritten modifications that Popovich had secreted in an East European country at a relative's house in order to protect himself. And when a finding of guilt was made against Popovich, he revealed this in order to try to defend himself. These documents include a draft of the lead paper typewritten by Popovich, which contains handwritten changes made to it by Gallo. The draft was the key evidence used in the above inquiries to establish that Gallo had concealed his laboratory's use of a cell culture known as LAV, which it received from the Institut Pasteur. This document provided the important evidence that established the basis for awarding Dr. Luc Montagnier and Francis Barré-Sinoussi the 2008 Nobel Prize in Medicine for the discovery of the AIDS virus by proving it was their samples of LAV that Popovich used. Going on, the letter says, related to these questions are other long-overlooked documents that merit your attention. One of these is a letter from Dr. Matthew Gonda, then head of electron microscopy at the National Cancer Institute, addressed to Popovich, copied to Gallo and dated just 4 days prior to Gallo's submissions to Science. In this letter, Gonda remarks on samples that had been sent for imaging because Dr. Gallo wanted these micrographs for publication because they contain HDLV. He states, I do not believe any of the particles photographed are of HDLV 1, 2, or 3. According to Gonda, one sample contained cellular debris, while another had no particles near the size of a retrovirus. Despite Gonda's clearly worded statements, Science published on May 4, 1984, papers attributed to Gallo with micrographs attributed to Gonda and described unequivocally as HDLV-3. In another letter by Gallo, one day before he submitted his papers to Science, Gallo states, "It's extremely rare to find fresh cells from AIDS patients expressing the virus. Cell culture seems to be necessary to induce virus. Cell culture is a highly artificial process that requires toxic chemicals and stimulants in order to get cells to do things that they wouldn't normally do." And this statement, the scientists go on to say, raises the possibility that Gallo was working with a laboratory artifact and not a real virus. Finally, the letter concludes, "For the scientific record to be reliable, it's vital that papers shown to be flawed or falsified be retracted. Because a very public record now exists showing that the Gallo papers drew unjustified conclusions, their withdrawal from science is all the more important to maintain integrity. Future researchers must also understand that they cannot rely on the 1984 Gallo papers for statements about HIV and AIDS, and all authors of papers that previously relied on this set of four papers should have the opportunity to consider whether their own conclusions are weakened by these revelations." This, of course, is why science ignored this letter, because basically every paper ever written about HIV and AIDS relies on the Gallo papers or similar work from Luc Montagnier, which has its own weaknesses. And so this is basically a very small foundation for a massive edifice. If the foundation is withdrawn, then the obvious occurs.
David, there's two points that you made that I want to re-emphasize. That the photographs that we were shown in Science magazine as proof that HIV existed, when the cell samples were sent over from Popovich to the head of the National Cancer Institute Electron Microscope Division, he stated he couldn't find it. So he can't find it, and that's in writing. I have a copy of that letter. You have a copy.
Mm-hmm.
Now we end up seeing a photograph, and he is the author. Either A, he lied, or B, they substituted a photograph that he did not take, gave him credit for it, which shows malice aforethought and scientific fraud. What is it?
Well, I think it's very clearly scientific fraud. And, I think the book by Crutzen and the government investigations make that very clear. One thing I find very interesting about this is how quickly Gonda was turned. You know, one day he's saying there's no retrovirus here, and then when push came to shove, the lure of having his name on a paper in Science, a seminal paper, you know, that was going to declare that HIV was the cause of AIDS, must have changed his mind, and all of a sudden he was okay with these electron micrographs being, misused.
But David, you can't have it both ways. You can't say that objectively we could find nothing, and then after Gallo comes back and sees that his report would have meant nothing, no discovery, no cause of AIDS by the HIV virus, nothing in that would have caused anyone to think twice about there's a problem. Suddenly he builds an entire foundation upon which all of science and medicine and legislation. Now, we know how easily corruptible politicians are, almost all of them. We know how easily corruptible scientists are. We know how completely corruptible the medical community is.
Right.
We see it with vaccines being safe and effective, which they're neither, and proven, and I'm doing a whole series on that as we speak. We see it in so many areas of medicine and science. So today we have to pull back and take an objective look. By the way, here is the actual verbatim statement. I have isolated the article with Luc Montagnier, and here's what he says. He says, quote, "There was so little production of virus, it was impossible to see what might be in a concentrate of virus from a gradient. There was not enough virus to do that. Of course, one looked for it. One looked for it in the tissues from the start. Likewise, in the biopsy, we saw some particles, but they did not have the morphology typical of retroviruses. They were very different, relatively different. So with the culture, it took many hours to find the first pictures. It was a Roman effort. It's easy to criticize after the event. What we did not have, I'm going to repeat this, what we did not have, and I always recognized it, was that it was truly the cause of AIDS." So there's a man who wins the Nobel Prize 2 years ago for discovering the HIV virus, who is stating on the record and being quoted exactly and accurately, because I have the article in front of me, we did not have, and I have always recognized it, was that it was truly the cause of AIDS. He also is saying that they don't know what they had. They think that it was of retrovirus, but then again, it did not have the morphology typical of retroviruses. So how could you say you've discovered a retrovirus when it's not the morphology of a retrovirus? And then say that, well, we couldn't find it in the biopsy. So if you're diagnosing, or if you're getting your virus from people who died of AIDS and you can't find HIV in their body, that would be like someone saying, here's a guy that just died of a gunshot battle. He had 21 bullets in his head. You take him into the morgue. You look and say, well, there's no bullet holes. Then you x-ray. Well, there's no bullets. And you open his brain. How did he die again? Gunshot wounds. Well, where's the wound? Where's the bullet? So how could you have people dying of full-blown AIDS? Do biopsies. Check their semen. Check their blood. And you can't find it. How is that supposed to be killing people? If you die of cancer, I can promise you we can find the cancer in your body. If you die of a stroke, we can see how that stroke occurred and what caused it. If you die of gangrene, we'll show you the rot. If you die of septicemia, massive amounts of bacteria. No matter what else we have, if you have any of the other major diseases, if you have arthritis in your joints, we can show you the inflammatory cytokines. But now we're supposed to say that someone just died of AIDS. Oh, we can't find any AIDS viruses in them, but we're sure it caused it. So these should have been contradictions, or at the very least challenges, that the media, science writers, scientists and physicians, public health advocates should have all jumped on and allowed this to be debated. There was no debate allowed. I was in one of the last debates that was allowed. I debated 6 scientists on AZT down at New York University Medical School. And they all said AZT is important. And I said, I have information from one of the researchers on the AZT trial that it was fraudulent. They had pulled their drugs together, so the placebo, which was a sugar pill, was sweet. They got rid of all the placebo, so they were all taking the AZT. People who died were excluded from the study. And all these other inconsistencies and all the documents to the FDA Oversight Committee I had copies of. They didn't want to know any of this. They all wanted to know that AZT was the ticket. And then when they started giving it to people, you start seeing people die like flies. So everywhere you look in this war on AIDS, you see lies, self-serving, and you see a blindness to the truth. Final thoughts before we go to our next panelist.
No, I think you've summarized it really well. I think the trick that they pulled was that they came out with this antibody test, and, you know, a lot of people who didn't think about it figured, well, you know, it's black or white now. We can tell if you've got HIV in your body, but, you know, if you think about it, you should know that antibodies don't tell you whether or not a virus is present. But this magic test that they could run seemed to answer all the questions, and then nobody had to ask any questions, is HIV really there or not? And if you read the test labels, it's pretty clear that the manufacturers are telling you, we can't tell you whether HIV is present or not. And so I think that was an important part of the sleight of hand that went on in the around 1984.
One final thought. When they were trying to explain that all you had to have is a less than 200 T4 cells, we took a group of 100 vegan, never drinking, never drug marathon runners. Mm-hmm. And a week before the New York City Marathon, after training for a year, they all had under 100 T cells, and some of them had previous conditions that gave them a positive HIV reading. None had AIDS. None had AIDS-defining illnesses. And after the marathon, when they regained their health, they all tested negative again. And I use that as a basis when speaking with the commissioner in New York of health of the AIDS war, that they were really wrong in what they were doing, because they were going to target people who may have low T cells for different reasons but otherwise be completely healthy. And yet the word was in. low T cells, put them on drugs.
Well, so, you could do a whole program just on T cells, because it's also known that smoking cigarettes has a significant causes CD4 cells to rise significantly. And so according to the whole HIV-AIDS hypothesis, smoking should be good for you, and exercise, as you pointed out, should be bad for you. So the whole CD4 counting business is crazy. But thank you so much for having me on your show, and I'm glad we were able to get this information on the history of AIDS out. And you've got two other really great guests that I'm looking
forward to. We're going
to
ask you to hold on, because at the end you're going to have final comments, all right? David Crowe, the president of the Reappraising AIDS Society, he also has a list of the thousands of activist scientists who are on the record challenging the AIDS paradigm. Our concern is the American media does not recognize that there is another side to the debate. Now we go to my next panelist, who is standing by, and he is Professor Henry Bauer. Professor Bauer is Professor Emeritus of Chemistry and Science Studies and a former dean at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. In his field, he is quite simply at the top of his field. He has received multiple honors. He is a scientist. So it was rather surprising to see someone who was such a stickler for real science to come out and challenge the HIV equals AIDS hypothesis. He's here now to do exactly that. Nice to have you with us today, Professor Bauer.
Thanks, Gary. It's nice to be with you. And hello, David and Celia. I'm really pleased to be visiting with you, even in this sort of way.
And Professor Bauer, as I did with David Crowan, as I will do with Celia Farber, because you have spent so many thousands of hours examining each of the major issues, I would encourage you, sir, to take your time. We are not limited by time. We're going right into the next hour. I would like you to take us through what you consider the points that all scientists should have seen, the red flags that were there and people chose not to examine, and what your investigations have found. Take your time. The forum is yours.
Well, as background, my main interest in academe for since the 1970s at least has been in trying to understand what the role in science is of controversies and unorthodoxies. And so I was always on the lookout for new cases to study. It was only in the 1990s, however, that I came across, that I realized that there were people who disagreed with the view that HIV causes AIDS. And, of course, that illustrates how the media and the scientific community have ignored and suppressed any dissenting voices on that. At any rate, I came across in the 1990s the book by Peter Duisberg, and I found it very interesting. I can't say that I made up my mind at that stage, but it led me to read whatever I could further about the arguments. And then in around 2003 or 2004, I read the scientific biography of Duisberg written by Harvey Bialy. And it had a sentence in there that I knew simply couldn't be true. It said that when the U.S. Army began to test recruits for HIV in the mid-1980s, they found that teenage women from all across the country tested HIV positive as often as teenage men. Now, the official view is that HIV came to the United States in the late 70s, And it came in groups, communities of gay men in a few large cities. It seemed obvious to me that in no way could a sexually transmitted disease spread in half a dozen years from closed communities of gay men in a few big cities in order to infect all across the country teenage women at about the same rate as teenage men. So, knowing this couldn't be correct, I eventually went to the original source that Viali quoted, and to my astonishment, I found that he had cited it quite correctly. So then I recalled, of course, that no single publication should be accepted as fact. And so I looked for other publications about HIV tests, the results of HIV tests. And that led to some months of real emotional turmoil for me because I simply couldn't believe what the data were showing. There was absolutely no doubt about it. Whatever group of people had been tested, it always was the case that the rate of HIV positive increased with age from the teens up to about middle age and then went down again. In any group where people of different racial categories were being tested, there was always the same regularity. African Americans always tested positive at something like 5 to 10 times more than white Americans, and white Americans always tested more positive than Asian Americans by about 50%. Those sort of regularities you do not find with an infection of any sort, let alone a sexually transmitted infection. It always also turned out that the distribution of positive HIV tests across the United States remained the same for decades. It was also the same whether you were testing low-risk groups like blood donors or relatively high-risk groups like the teenagers in the and young adults in the Job Corps, which enrolls disadvantaged youths. So the epidemiology, the distribution of this so-called HIV demonstrated with absolute clarity that whatever is being measured is not something that's infectious. Now, as a matter of fact, the very first article that I had seen, the one about those teenagers, already said that. It noted the peculiarity that the particular districts where HIV seemed to be most common was not the same as the districts in which AIDS was most common. So there was no correlation between the two. And I was really rather disturbed to find that some of the mainstream publications were nothing short of incompetent. There was one publication, I believe in Science magazine, by people from the Centers for Disease Control that showed a couple of maps claiming that the distribution of HIV and of AIDS in the United States overlapped, that the two were correlated. But when you took the actual numbers cited in that publication, you found that it was nothing of the sort. Another indication of incompetence was an early article by two senior members of the Centers for Disease Control saying that in Africa, they had noted amongst a group of young African men that those who were HIV positive died at a greater rate than those who were HIV negative, and they said, therefore, whether or not HIV causes AIDS, HIV certainly kills. Now, this is committing the most fundamental statistical fallacy that students are warned against when they first study statistics, namely, that just because two things are correlated, it doesn't mean that one is the cause of the other. And yet the CDC commits that fallacy all the time, and in fact, the wider medical literature, unfortunately, commits that same error. In that sense, I would disagree or differ a little bit from something you said in the introduction, namely that HIV/AIDS is a unique case because things were not done in the way that you expect them to be done in science. The fact of the matter is that things are done in science, and particularly in medical science, all the time in ways that you would not expect things to be done if people were keeping to the original ideals of science, which are to put the data first and attempt to test hypotheses against the data, and to be prepared to ditch, to get rid of hypotheses if the data don't support them. Well, when I had astonished myself by finding that the demography, the epidemiology, was so clear-cut, I was a little bit naive. I thought that the CDC and the Army Research Group that had published those things might be interested in discussing it with me. And so I sent them my analysis of the data and asked them whether they could tell me where I had gone wrong. And the Army Research Group never replied, even though I sent a follow-up. The Centers for Disease Control eventually sent me a letter from a not very senior person telling me that there was absolutely nothing wrong with my data collection, and the trends that I saw were correct. In other words, that the distribution across the states had not changed for 20 years, that HIV and AIDS were not correlated geographically, that there were these tremendous racial disparities. They said I was quite right about those trends, but they said they could all be explained on the basis of how people behave. In other words, they were prepared to say that African Americans are so much more promiscuous or used to injecting themselves with illegal drugs, with infected needles, that they are so much more prone to do that than white Americans or Asian Americans, that essentially HIV/AIDS had become a disease of African Americans. And I was taken aback by that, I must admit. But I'm sorry to say that you can read a great deal of the mainstream literature and find the same sort of implicit racism there. For example, James Chin, who used to be the epidemiologist for the World Health Organization, later became professor of epidemiology at Berkeley, published a book called The AIDS Pandemic, in which he said, amongst other things, that the estimates that UNAIDS puts out are grossly exaggerated. But secondly, he said that the only way to explain the how common HIV or AIDS are in Africa is to infer that 20 to 40% of adult Africans are engaged in promiscuous relationships with an average of 10 partners each, changing those partners on average once a year. Now, I mean, that sort of scenario is absolutely absurd. And in any case, I mean, that sort of behavior would have been so obvious, but nobody seems to have noticed it. In fact, one of the things when I was writing my book, I found quite a number of actual social studies of sexual behavior, and invariably they found that Africans in Africa and African Americans in the United States are, if anything, more responsible and less promiscuous than are Caucasians or white Americans. So the epidemiology seems to me to be quite clear, and I eventually published a book containing that, and then setting it out. And then after the book was published, I started a blog so that I could explain how what I had found about the epidemiology really could be used to critique the continuing news items coming out. Well, as a result of that, I received very useful information from many people, and I did some further analyses of HIV and AIDS data in the United States. And I think one of the most striking things that happened was that I calculated from CDC data what the death rate was for people who had been diagnosed with AIDS and how that death rate changes with age. Now, you know that as we get older, we're less able to resist any sort of stress, any sort of illness. And in fact, any disease that you look at, the mortality rate, the death rate, goes up quite sharply, especially after about early middle age. Well, if you look at people with AIDS, there is no indication of any increase in death rate with age. 30-year-old people, so-called with AIDS, are dying at the same rate as 70-year-old people with AIDS. This is absurd. It means that the diagnosis of AIDS is not the diagnosis of an illness. Another startling thing that I found was by comparing the age distribution of people being found to be HIV positive, of people being diagnosed with AIDS and of people dying. And it turns out that those distributions overlap almost exactly, and the maximum, the age at which people are most likely to be tested positive for HIV, the age at which they're most likely to be diagnosed with AIDS, and the age at which they're most likely to die from one of those, supposedly from one of those things, those ages are all the same. They're in the range of about 35 to 45. And this is another absurdity, that you would have a disease that strikes people in the prime years of adulthood more than it does young kids or the elderly. Furthermore, one of the tenets of HIV/AIDS theory is that there's a so-called latent period of a decade or so between infection with HIV and illness or AIDS. Well, when those three distributions overlap, it demonstrates that there is no latent period. So in other words, the science is absolutely clear-cut. And the question of why the mainstream has resisted acknowledging these things is really a question of politics and social arrangements, vested interests, and so on. I don't personally believe that there has been a deliberate conspiracy by large numbers of people to suppress the evidence. In a sense, it's much worse than that. There is so much ignorance and incompetence that a huge mistake like this, a debilitating mistake like this, that has harmed hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people, that this can have persisted for so long. I think one sort of aspect of it is that science research has become so specialized that people only know about the tiny little aspect of something that they're actually working on, and they accept on trust what other specialists in neighboring areas do. And so a mistake can persist, can snowball, and can remain in effect, in this case, for decades.
Dr. Bauer, I'd like to ask you for a very short answer on three questions, all right?
Sure.
Do you believe that HIV was fully isolated?
No.
Do you believe that HIV by itself is the cause of 30 different conditions we call AIDS?
Certainly not.
Do you believe that the HIV antibody test is the accurate determining test to see if you have antibodies to the virus?
Definitely not. And there's a mainstream chapter by Weiss and Cohn mainstream monograph that says that quite clearly.
All right. I'm going to ask you to hold your thoughts. I'll come back near the end of the program for summation from you, all right?
Sure.
And just so people understand, you're listening to Professor Henry Bauer, B-A-U-E-R. Dr. Bauer is one of America's most respected scientists and has been his entire adult career. And having been the dean at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and a professor emeritus of chemistry and science studies, and also the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration for 7 years, and on the advisory board or editorial position within other scientific magazines, peer-reviewed magazines, he has an unblemished reputation. So for someone who is, in effect, a scientist to be speaking out as he has, to go on the record as he has, and then he is talking about the incompetence, the ignorance, or the dismissiveness of so much of the scientific community, and that's why we have him on. Now to our final panelist. Celia Farber is a journalist, award-winning journalist, who has covered the HIV wars extensively for over 25 years. Nice to have you with us today, Celia.
Nice to be here, Gary.
Celia, as I did with David Crowe and Professor Bauer, I would like for you to take unlimited time. There is no rushing. I believe that we should learn from context and not the hyper steroid-inducing questions and answers that you see so often. I like a measured, slow, methodical unraveling of the story. In your case, I'm going to be asking you to explore what you have found as a journalist who had no preconceived notions of what the story was, what you found that startled you, and what you found that startled you that the American journalists weren't willing to acknowledge, the bias within journalism, including the New York Times, Washington Post, and other publications, and the refusal of the American scientific community, including its major magazines, the Journal of the American Medical Association, New England Journal of Medicine, Immunology, Cell Biology, and all the others, 8,000 scientific publications in the United States, refusing to find the same information that you and over 2,000 scientists and journalists and physicians have found and gone on the record, why you believe that we have a closed rank around the AIDS orthodoxy of media, politicians, the National Institutes of Health, National Institutes of Infectious Disease and Allergies, and all these others, and against you, against the few journalists who have told the truth. In my opinion, one of the most courageous journalists was Charles Ortley, the publisher of the New York Native, and Nina Amstrand, one of the most important journalists on this subject. They were so involved in this, and their reputations were adversely affected and their publication closed down because they were telling what they considered the truth. So tell us your story and put it into context for us.
Oh, yeah, I've been relaxing here as my colleagues have been working very hard to address this morass. The mathematician Serge Lange famously said, "How do you address a morass without becoming part of it?" And I've been pulling back in recent years and asking myself, and really taking my time, not being exactly gainfully employed in journalism, taking my time and trying to understand what did we not understand at all about this story. And the piece I've been working on is about the media and journalism. And really it's about our mythology about journalism, my own included. And in recent weeks, actually in getting down to work on a piece that I'm writing for you that I know is late, but I'm working on it, I've really been delving into what is the media and why do we keep talking about it as something that it absolutely is not, namely an organ in the body of society that exists to express the truth about the world as far as we can tell. I think no definition of media could be further from the truth. It's also a little bit facile to say, as many people do, well, it's an arm and an extension of corporate America. Yes, of course it is. But the only thing I've been able to kind of, where I've been able to really shift and go to a different level on my thinking lately is, I mean, unlike many of my respected colleagues in this fight. I was not able to, and after a certain point, I started in 1986, 87, there came a point when I could no longer work with, quote, the science and the evidence and the discrepancies. It became too psychologically overwhelming. So I had to step back and say, okay, what are we looking at here? And I've always felt that there was some kind of, I have to use the word, hysteria or psychosis going on. And in a sense, we didn't address that because we, earnest critics, kept addressing the science. I'm not going to say that was a mistake. That had to be done. It was intrepid, and it was absolutely essential. But heartbreakingly, it hasn't made much of a dent in the propaganda machinery. Now, I'm not addressing what, quote, people think, and I don't think the media is a reflection of what people think. But here's my shift in thinking, Gary. The mistake, for lack of a better word, that we all made was to tackle this as science, and journalism tackles things as evidence-based. We should have understood it and addressed it as religion. Two things, religion and ideology. So as I was sitting here this evening, I actually looked up the definition of religion, and it fits HIV/AIDS perfectly. There are many definitions, but this is the first one I came upon. The belief in and worship of a superhuman controlling power. The belief in and worship of a superhuman controlling power. Now, I wrote in an article called Fatal Distraction, published in Spin Magazine in 1992. In my opening, I wrote about HIV as a deity, a negative deity. I really do feel that this is the crux of the matter, and this is why it doesn't seem to matter what any of us produce in terms of shocking, crushing, devastating, mind-boggling evidence to the contrary of the hypothesis. The reason it doesn't matter is because this thing took root at the level of religion and ideology. If I may, I want to read a further definition of religion. Now think of AIDS. We're coming up on World AIDS Day, the red ribbon, all of it. Here it is. A collection of cultural systems, belief systems, and worldviews that establishes symbols that relate humanity to spirituality and sometimes to moral values. Now, I then looked up ideology. Here's a definition of ideology. The body of doctrine, myth, symbols, etc., with reference to some political or cultural plan, as that of communism, along with the procedures for putting it into operation. So, I know I'm stating the obvious. We have always said, it's like a religion, it's like an ideology. But I'm now saying it literally is. Religions don't peter out, quit, go away, pack up and say we were wrong. They just don't. And so I no longer am in the Sisyphean camp, really, of trying to bring it to light and bring it down and raise aware. I consider it impossible because I consider HIV/AIDS to have become a religion. So that's not exactly defeatism. It's just a thinking about it in a way that allows me and maybe other people, if we can make this shift, to stop bloodying ourselves against this Berlin Wall here to stop taking on that which is actually impossible. I was there from the outset. I wasn't there as early as you, and I wasn't there as early as Chuck Ortlieb. I'm glad you mentioned him. I say every chance I get. I don't know why people don't bring up Chuck Ortlieb more often, but he broke this story in the media, not just American media, the media period. The native broke the story. Actually, I think Gary Null broke the story in Penthouse, Gary Null and Chuck Ortlieb. I came along in 1987, in the fall of 1987, interviewed Peter Duisberg for Spin magazine, and I want to kind of bring us back to that, the climate in the media in the 80s, to try to address what you're asking, what you're rightly asking, and I know you've been asking it all these years, as have I. How could the media drop this ball? Again, I'm shifting in my thinking. I no longer view the media with the mythology that I used to. I don't think they made any mistakes. I don't think they betrayed any cherished, sacred journalistic values that they once held. I don't think the media or journalism or the press ever really was what we speak of. And let me give a very obvious example. Actually, I'm going to read a quote that is from a great journalist, George Orwell. It was actually from an essay he wrote as part of a preface to Animal Farm. It was never published until 29 years after The Tortured Animal Farm was finally published. So this essay, it's called The Freedom of the Press, was not even published until sometime in the early 70s. And here's the quote. At any given moment, there is an orthodoxy, a body of ideas, which it is assumed that all right-thinking people will accept without question. It is not exactly forbidden to say this, that, or the other, but it is, quote, not done to say it, just as in mid-Victorian times it was not done to mention trousers in the presence of a lady. Anyone who challenges the prevailing orthodoxy finds himself silenced with surprising effectiveness. The orthodoxy that Orwell was invoking at the time was, which as we speak of the West, quote, an uncritical admiration of Soviet Russia. Okay, so let's unpack that a little more. So we think, oh, the press. What did the media do about the Stalin-induced famines in the Ukraine, the so-called Holodomor? As we know, the New York Times had a KGB agent, whether they knew that or not, covering the story for the New York Times, named Walter Duranty, I mean, later found to be KGB, who absolutely whitewashed the bloody history that he saw and experienced with his own eyes, and his dispatches were absolutely just raw apologia for Stalin and very reassuring to those who did not want to think. In other words, let's just call them denialists of the crimes of Stalin. Duranty got a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on Stalin. Okay, fair enough. Everybody was taken up with the fever of the time. But then what happens? So the story is finally broken. Actually, people think that Malcolm Muggeridge was the first to break the true story of the Ukraine famines, but it was a guy who I'm pretty sure his name is Gareth Jones. Gareth Jones somehow snuck into the Soviet Union and documented what was happening and got the documents shipped out and broke the story, and then Muggeridge picked up on that. So those two were basically the only game in town. Muggeridge was sliced out of his profession, sent off to India, driven to near suicide from not working, from condemnation, and so on and so forth. And really the only reason, this is a bit of an aside, but the only reason Muggeridge apparently made this shift to speak of these horrors in the way that he did in his prose was because he had a conversion to the Christian faith. But again, that's a digression. The point being, this enormous, ginormous story that unlike with AIDS, it really was, there were no complications. This was a matter of mass death by the millions that anyone could see with their plain eyes. And the entire Western media closed its eyes, closed its ears, punished those who tried to open our eyes. In other words, so, I mean, I've known all this for years. We all know this. But I didn't really put it together that what actually has happened is that we've been sold a bill of goods for a very long time about what the quintessence of media is in the West, what it even is. I think personally that there's something deeply sinister at the very heart and root system of the Western media that we don't know what it is. It has something to do with, I'll just say radical, profound social engineering. It's social engineering. And if you actually delve into kind of like the, if you look at the media today, okay, people think the media, it's these newspapers that we know about, it's these network TV networks that we know about, and then over there there's Fox, and you know, we have these kind of identifiable characters, you might say, in media, but there's a vast terrain of new media out there, and I put media in heavy quotation marks, that is actually created by, funded by, and run by the healthcare industry, like the Kaiser Family Foundation and so forth. And they really have built a kind of secondary superimposed media empire. And that is where health journalism, again, heavy quotes, health and science journalism, that's where it resides. That's what it is. And if you look at their openly stated agenda, as they say in all of their unending conferences and panel discussions about the future of journalism, the future of health journalism, the future and the responsibility and the ethics, they love having panels about that stuff. So you can read it, and it's point blank, they will say, what we need to do is finally, totally merge essentially our agenda with a media that is cooperative and responsible. And the way we're going to do that is by training them, sponsoring them, helping them to understand the complex scientific and medical issues. And then you look at the media, which has been financially strapped to the point of extinction. So what do you think they're going to do? So first of all, one distinction I'd like to make is between journalism and science journalism. I don't think there's any element in journalism that is sicker than so-called science journalism in precisely this regard, that is more sold out, more compromised, more twisted. I think, you know, you can still find financial journalism. You can still find, journalism about food and many big themes that are important. You can still find real journalism, but health, science, and God forbid, AIDS, it's really over. I just see it as a blacked out planet at this point.
So yeah, I want to intercede here on several levels. I'm going to throw out multiple points and then see if we can connect them, all right?
Okay.
Some may seem distant from what you are discussing. I see them as connected. I believe that virtually all of American media, official media, has always dealt in the creation of an illusion. They have their own agendas, they have the people who need to sell a message, and they have the power to bring the most articulate, attractive people to a given forum through foundations and think tanks, the Heritage Foundation, the Free Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute, whichever it is, and say, here's why we should go to war in Iraq. Here's why we should bomb Iran. Here's why we should support unquestionably Israel against the Arabs. Here, and then they go down a list of talking points. Those talking points then are supported by multiple groups of people from different foundations, giving the impression that you have objectivity. Much like listening to Juan Williams on Fox act as if he's speaking as a liberal. No, he is a Clinton Democrat, Obama Democrat. He's a corporatist, and he's an embarrassment to anyone who is truly a historical liberal Democrat out of the FDR mode. And he's light years away from being progressive on any issue. But the same is true of the people who talk as if they are absolutely convinced, which they may be, of the rightness of their position. That means that the American media will form a story based upon stated and obvious non-stated concern for its own survival. PBS did a special on British Petroleum and its oil spill. And who did PBS rely upon as a better, more ethical source for the way energy should be dealt with and the industry? Chevron. And they happen to be a major sponsor of PBS. That kind of insidious influence is not obvious to the American public. But everywhere you look in journalism, especially health journalism, you will find absolute barriers where no matter what your evidence, no matter how much fact you have, you will not move a mind. You will not open a mind. I remember once sitting in the Roosevelt Hotel to about 1,400 people I was about to do a lecture with, and a reporter for the New York Post was there and asking me questions. And I said, why don't you just speak with the people? They're here, and this way you can see what why they're here. And she chose not to. I said, I'm going to be doing a press conference on AIDS. This week we're going to have 100 individuals from around the United States with their physicians and medical records who've all made improvements, some completely curing AIDS, and 12 of those people are people I personally work with. The medical doctors involved, a group of scientists who are there to explain any aspect of why a therapy worked, whether it was ozone, vitamin drips, the Louise Hay method, neuro-linguistic programming, any number of therapies that have been used. The scientists have over 25,000 studies in peer-reviewed literature they can refer to if you say, well, how is it that vitamin C helped a person with AIDS? And I said, so come and see this. Person wouldn't. We contacted 7,000 journalists. They received three notices, a personal phone call from an ad agency, a PR agency, a fax, and then another announcement that was sent out. On the day that we had the press conference, which you can see up on GaryNoll.com, you'll see a room full of persons, all of whom had been diagnosed with full-blown AIDS. They all had opportunistic infections, and all of them were there with their physicians, had their medical records to show that it was not anecdotal. They had hard scientific blood workups, etc., for all their various AIDS conditions, Kaposi's sarcoma, pneumocystis, carina pneumonia, thrush, whatever it might have been. And today they had either made major improvements or were completely HIV negative and had no health issues whatsoever. Not one member of the American media showed up. Not one.
And well, yet, exactly. They don't care, Gary. Well, they don't care. They don't care if you produce Jesus Christ to address this. They don't. It doesn't matter. It took me 25 years to come to that very painful realization. What they are doing is acting as what they feel themselves to be. What they feel themselves to be are agents of the greater good. The greater good, which is the name, by the way, of an outstanding documentary that's just come out about the vaccine issue. I've had these discussions and fights, and I've been relentlessly attacked, and through these attacks, there's been a consistent blue thread, and the thread has not exactly been, we looked at the evidence and you are wrong. The thread has all been based on a deeper sin. If this message gets out to the public, how might they behave? What might they think? Might they have unsafe sex? Might they think that HIV is not so deadly? In other words, we are tasked with controlling the public, the messages it receives, controlling thoughts, behavior, hopes, aspirations, and so forth. And I think that is the ideological divide right there between a certain kind of journalist, a minority kind, and you might say radical. I guess we could be called radicals in the sense that we believe that the imperative of journalism is to investigate. The imperative of American journalism is to educate, which is a word that gives me chills. It's creepy. Carrie Mullis once at a conference that many of us presented at in San Francisco in sometime in the mid-90s, I think it was in 1994, I think it was at that conference that Carrie Mullis said something very simple, very profound, very important when this grenade was thrown at him. He said, "I'm not a lifeguard, I'm a scientist." And that's it right there. You have to pick one side. Do you feel yourself to be in the business of changing public opinion? And this is what the big bureaucracies have been so successful at. The tentacles have grown so far and reach into every element of entertainment and Hollywood. I mean, the CDC has multi-million-dollar programs advising Hollywood scripts and television scripts. And this is an abject horror. This is a totalitarian system of propaganda. And it just swept over us. We didn't react in time. We didn't wake up. And I don't know what to say about the future other than let me try to steer back to the hope. And the hope is, of course, the new technologies that ironically, paradoxically, are putting new freedom back into the hands of, you might say, citizen journalists, people. Really, there's no such thing as a journalist. People. There are people, and people come across information, and people process and pollinate information. And I would like for there to be a new idea about media in the future, which is that it does not at all exist in the way that we all thought it did, as this kind of governing body of right and wrong, true and false, that really this morass that we've been trapped by and brainwashed by, controlled by, has obviously been it's a tumor. It's a tumor, and we can't cut it away out. It's not going to go away. It's massively funded. All they do is give each other the highest awards, fund each other to go off on all kinds of conferences and join all kinds of global PR societies and so forth. So they're set, and it's a very cushy life. But what you have to do is sign away every notion that you're a journalist if you're going to play that game.
Let me intercede again. I would look at patterns of behavior before I would make such a statement that this is a religion. And when I look at vaccines, I've just published 4 articles in the last 2 months. I published 12 articles last year on this, and I have 3 more coming out, one this week and one next week. And I simply ask us 2 simple questions. Are vaccines safe and effective? And if so, what is the proof? And the process is trying to prove they're safe and effective. I found that they're neither safe nor effective, nor have there ever been double-blind placebo-controlled studies against non-vaccinated people, so you have a real control. And their science is just terrible. And yet, when you present this information and you say to them, show me where I'm wrong, show me the evidence, prove to me that the polio vaccine cured polio, prove it. And I can prove to you that virtually all the cases of polio were caused by your vaccine. And then you give them Maurice Hilleman's, the most famous vaccine maker in America's actual word-for-word statement that he made just before he died. And he says, yeah, all these vaccines were dangerous. They were all unsafe. They had cancer cells in them, and we knew it, but we hid it from the public, including the Sabin, who was my friend, he said, and he went ballistic, and we said, we'll just cover it up. Now, near his end of his life, he's telling the truth. Did it change any of our views? No. So I have found no one in science, no one, willing to acknowledge that the entire paradigm, the vaccination equals immunization, is true. I've interviewed dozens of immunologists, looked in hundreds of their studies. The evidence isn't there. So that is a point on your side. Then take autism. I've interviewed over 2,600 families whose children were completely normal till they received vaccines and different combinations and then became autistic or on the spectrum disorder. They have been denied the virtue of being given an opportunity to have credibility in their statements. The government, the agencies, the American Academy of Pediatrics have joined ranks and said there is no danger to vaccines. It does not cause autism. Thimerosal doesn't cause autism. Now we know all that's lies. We have their internal documents under Freedom of Information Act showing that they knew that the vaccines caused autism, and they hid it. And one of these is just an article that we broke just 2 weeks ago. Will it change anything? Not at all. At all. Then you have clean coal going off that into the idea that the Democrats are supporting Obama because he's giving us healthy green technology, clean coal. Well, what kind of oxymoron is clean coal? There's no science whatsoever that coal can be made clean. Then you have the making up of diseases that do not exist, like social anxiety disorder and math defiance disorder and parental defiance disorder, as if these are real chemical imbalances in the brain requiring psychiatric diagnosis and treatment. Complete nonsense, and yet they consider that scientific-based medicine. Therefore, it is acknowledged, funded, and is now held in a court of law. So if a psychiatrist deems that you suffer from a made-up disease but tells the court that you have social anxiety disorder, the court then can hold that you will be institutionalized or forced into a medicated program because of this. Again, an entire medical community, not only asleep at the wheel, 900,000 physicians, but complicit in this. Synthetic hormone replacement therapy. For 35 years, we've known that it caused heart attack, stroke, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, dementia, colorectal cancer, and yet it is still used by 10 million American women with 13% minimal adverse effects. That means 1.3 million women at any given time could end up dying or being injured, but we are told there's no alternative. A, it doesn't work for what it was told, and B, we do have alternatives. It won't change. The same is true for nuclear power. It's green, it's clean, it doesn't cause global warming. None of that is true. We have the evidence, we have the science. They refuse to acknowledge it. The media refuse to acknowledge it. You have not had any single media, not the New York Times, the Washington Post, Philadelphia Inquirer, the Miami Herald, the Boston Globe, the San Francisco Chronicle, the LA Times. No major media will acknowledge that everything we've been told about nuclear is a lie. Yet we've proven it. I have a multi-award-winning documentary out right now called Knocking on the Devil's Door, which proves that. The number one cause of death in the United States, by their statistics, is American medicine. Iatrogenic medicine is causing more people to die than die of heart attack, stroke, or cancer. And over 9 million are injured, making it the number one cause of death, number one cause of injury, both preventable. I did a 20-year analysis. The most conservative figure I have is 10 million dead Americans. Now, wouldn't you think, Celia, that if 10 million people died of any reason, and they shouldn't have, that that would make someone's let's pay attention list? Not a single member of the American media has paid attention to that. So I did a documentary.
Well, we agree.
This year, we
essentially agree.
Death by medicine. So what I'm seeing in my work is that I no longer write ever, broadcast ever, for the left or the right, the media, the medical community. I consider them all incapable by design of having two realities and two truths face them simultaneously. It goes back to that law of dynamics, that no two energies can share the same space with equal intensity at the same time. So their dominant conditioned belief system becomes their, in your opinion, their religion. And I believe that's a very unique insight. As a result, what the rest of us who are working outside of that paradigm find in science, in medicine, in public health care, in education, in finance, in any area, is no longer welcome. It has no place to fit. Now, my final thought. Go back to what I said at the beginning of this program, that for decades you had no forum unless it was fitting into an existing paradigm that was both ideological, philosophical, sociological, and political, and frequently racial. The ideologies did not fit me or my audience, but it was the only forums I had. Now we have progressive radio. So I believe that what is happening is you're not alone, Dr. Bauer's not alone, David Crow is not alone, and 2,800 other AIDS dissidents are not alone. Those million families who are suffering from autism are not alone. The women who want natural but biological hormone replacement therapy and not synthetic hormone replacement therapy are not alone. The people who are against the drugging of our children, against the gas hydrofracking, against the police state mentality, we're not alone, because we don't have to fit into a Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, Amy Goodman, or one of the radical left, and who are just as ramrod rigid as limousine liberals are, the right are, as close to fascism as can be bred. All of these people are not going to be moved to the truth, will not report on it, and yet will believe completely in the rightness of their position. Therefore, you are right. The whole world has become an extended belief system, an ideology, inflexible, immovable, and inoperable towards truth. Your final comment, Celia Farber.
Yeah, I want to read something. This is from, I want to be specific, this document, the point I was making about, I realized this, and it was a huge shock. This is a discovery I made only within the last couple of weeks. I thought to myself, what's going on with all these journalism schools? I don't know if this figure is accurate, but there are some 450, perhaps more, journalism schools in the United States. A mushrooming culture of science, health, environmental programs. These are sponsored directly and indirectly by pharmaceutical corporations as well as foundations, and they're devoted to, this is a direct quote, fostering responsible reporting on health care through the education of science journalists and numerous media fellowships. Now, I want to read this. This is from his opening remarks at a conference called The Future of Healthcare Journalism. It took place in March 2009. The head of this organization is a man named Matt James, and here's his direct quote. And again, his theme is the state of health journalism. Health journalism is a subject that we have long been interested in at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Back in the early 90s, soon after Drew Altman became president of the foundation, one of the very first projects he asked me to take on was to come up with a project that would help health journalists understand the many complex issues that they have to wrestle with in explaining health policy to the American public. After consulting with a number of journalists, editors, healthcare experts, journalism experts around the country, we came up with the idea for the Kaiser Media Fellowships in Health Program, which was the very first operating program at the Kaiser Family Foundation. We were actually still a grant maker back then, and this was our first operating program. More recently, we have decided to take a very bold step and launch our very own health news service, Kaiser Health News, or KHN, because we felt there was a real danger that with the changes in the news business, there was a danger that news organizations would not be adequately focused on health policy, as they were trying to focus on a great many issues with less staff and a smaller news hole. We're now in a sort of soft launch phase and have begun to collaborate with a number of news organizations, such as the Washington Post and the Philadelphia Inquirer, which ran this excellent story this week on hospital emergency room super users. We have brought on a couple of well-known health policy journalists, some of whom I know you know. Today will be joining us, and then he lists who these people are. I am proud to say, okay, this is the money quote, we're adding additional reporters at this time. In fact, I am proud to say we are one of the few news organizations in America that is now hiring people. These people gave out a 94-page manual called the HIV/AIDS Reporting Manual that tells journalists, it's pre-answered, guidelines, how to think about the issue, how to pitch a story, when to report on it, what the sensitivity issues are, reporting on it, by the way, big anniversaries like the one coming up, what you want to say about this terrible disease. It's literally a pre-digested 94-page manual that is given. In other words, it's beyond even Orwell. Not only here's your story, the journalist is instructed to do precisely zero journalism, zero, to just absolutely absorb, digest, and regurgitate what they're being told. So we've reached the end of journalism. I'm sorry I went on a bit, but that's basically my conclusion.
We've reached the end of official journalism. You're a journalist. I'm a journalist. David Crowe is a journalist. We have a lot of journalists who will still maintain a different mindset because we do not look at what we're doing as religion. We do not bring a predetermined bias into our view. We look for the truth wherever it is. That's what
we report. Gary, then we have to officially come up with the language for distinctions to be made then between these two different journalisms, so it's not one big globule.
Why don't we just call it real journalist? Celia, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for your continuing efforts in this field. Progressive Radio Network has an article or articles from Celia Farber that will be posted in the very near future on our front page. And for all the millions of people who are listening and coming to the blog, I'm sure you'll look forward to this original piece. Celia, thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary, so much.
Closing comment from Professor Henry Bauer. Dr. Bauer, your final thoughts, please.
Yes, I think what I would like to leave us with is my view that I've come to quite recently is that the mistake of HIV/AIDS really is not unique, but it rather exemplifies the way in which medical science in particular has come to be not evidence-based. People talk about evidence-based medicine a lot nowadays without realizing that the term was started by people who were trying to bring medicine to become evidence-based, and they haven't got very far with it. I think that the lack of public understanding and the role of journalists and so on we discussed is absolutely correct. And I would like to mention a book by a historian, John Burnham, published, believe it or not, in 1987, and the title is How Superstition Won and Science Lost. And he gives many examples to support that. And in effect, he's saying that what Celia pointed out, that what we call science and medical science nowadays is a religion. And let me give you just one example of how entirely irrational some very common medical practice is nowadays that has nothing to do with HIV and AIDS. Everyone knows that high blood pressure, hypertension, causes heart disease, and that it's very desirable to lower your blood pressure. What everybody seems to overlook is what you can find in all the literature, that blood pressure of healthy, normal people increases with age, and yet the current medical practice is to regard as hypertension a blood pressure that is reached by normal, healthy, average people at about age 50 or 60. The result is that we are now claiming that 75 to 80% of people over age 60 have hypertension and should be medicated in order to bring that pressure down. And yet there's not a jot of actual proof that high blood pressure is a cause of any diseases. Instead, it is something that accompanies aging in a natural sort of way. And again, the medical profession is taking correlations, associations, as showing cause. And it doesn't. As we get older, we tend to die at a greater rate from every type of disease. Cardiovascular disease increases with age, cancer increases with age, and so on. At the same time, blood pressure increases with age, cholesterol level increases with age, and so on. Therefore, there's a correlation between high blood pressure and cardiovascular disease, stroke, heart attacks, and all the rest of it. But the cause of all those things is just aging. And we are being over-treated, over-medicated, and that message, that knowledge is present in dozens of books published in the last couple of decades by highly competent people, but public discourse seems to be completely ignorant of those facts. So unfortunately, dreadful as the HIV/AIDS mistake is, it is not uncharacteristic of the present day situation in medical science, medical practice, and science generally. Thanks very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Professor Henry Bauer. Final comments from David Crow.
Yeah, a couple of things I'd like to say. Some of the dogmas of the religion that is medicine, and in particular HIV/AIDS medicine, one is that science is incorruptible when there was dramatic evidence of scientific fraud related to Robert Gallo. Nobody except John Crutzen of the Chicago Tribune seemed to care. If it was covered at all, it was covered in quite a hostile fashion, against shoot the messenger kind of fashion. Another factor, I think, in HIV/AIDS is the rejection of environmental causes. The CDC did not want to know that drugs known as poppers were potentially the cause of AIDS, and so they just ignored it and went on as if the only hypothesis was viral. I think one of the big mistakes that's rarely talked about is that the first two diseases, Kaposi sarcoma and PCP, were also found in patients taking immune suppressive drugs. And that led to the conclusion that that the connection between KS and PCP must be immune suppression must be caused by a virus due to the rejection of environmental causes. It could equally have been a cause to look at a chemical, look for a chemical that could be causing both immune suppression and cancer, and paupers are known to be immune suppressive and carcinogenic. And finally, the insanity of using an antibody test to detect infection with a virus, when normally we believe that antibodies generate after exposure to a virus, and when you clear your body of the virus, the antibodies remain. So there are numerous insanities, but the media, politicians, the medical establishment all wanted a really simple answer that drove money towards the pride of American industry, which is the medical structure that probably kills a million people a year.
One final thought I will have on this is that all orthodoxy has its defenders, and within those defenders there are those individuals who do the attack. We have a tiny little insignificant group called ACT UP, and they are the attack dogs for the AIDS industry. At no time will they come forward and debate the credible scientists and journalists and activists on any of these issues. And yet the media gives them credibility, much like the media has given the quackbusters credibility when each and every one of their statements can be completely deconstructed as false and without scientific basis, and has been. And yet the media, including the New York Times, uses these individuals as their credible sources, which shows that they have no intent of using legitimate techniques to determine the quality and veracity of a source on an issue. So they have their defenders, and the truth is always going to be the casualty. I want to thank my panelists, Suya Farber, David Crowe, and Professor Henry Bauer, and I'll end with this statement. I believe all this shows how much of our lives are lived through illusion. And author Kussler said, nothing is more sad than the death of an illusion. Why? Because of what we should understand. It was H. Somerset Maugham who said, it is dangerous to let the public behind the scenes. They are easily disillusioned, and then they are angry with you, for it was the illusion they loved. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all very much for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.